Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
From ABC, this is the 10% Happier podcast. I'm Dan Harris. We've got two people on this time. If you were going to design a meditation show, these are probably the two least likely people you would have on the show. One is a neuroscientist. The other is a major general in the U.S. Army. And they know each other. They've worked together, bringing mindfulness to the troops. We're going to hear about how this whole thing came about. But let me just tell you who they are first. Dr. Amishi Jha is a neuroscientist and an associate professor of psychology at the University of Miami. She studies how the demands of high-stress, high-stakes professions may degrade the brain's ability to make decisions. And she has found in her work that groups like accountants, students, athletes, and military service members benefit from mindfulness training. The other guest is Major General Walt Piatt of the U.S. Army. Walt began his military career as an enlisted soldier when he entered the Army service in 1979. He's had a more than 35-year career. He served in numerous assignments all over the world, including tours in Korea, Panama, Hawaii, and Alaska. He's also completed several operational deployments, including Suriname, Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Such a pleasure to have you both on the show. Thank you for coming up.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So I'm going to start with the question I start with everybody, and I'm going to pick on you first, Amishi, just because we know each other better. How and why did you come to meditation?
So I'd say the answer is in two parts. The first is a personal need, and I guess very much similar to your story. I didn't have a panic attack on national TV.
Were you doing cocaine?
I was not doing cocaine.
Okay. So not really similar to my story.
Similar in the sense that I had a growing understanding that it was my mind that was causing me a lot of pain.
Gotcha.
I was a new faculty member and a new mom at the University of Pennsylvania at that time. And everything outwardly looked fine. I was continuing to have success at a great institution. But the stress of it was actually crippling. And at some point, I realized, like, I don't want to live my life like this, and turned to my husband, actually, at that point, and said, I think I'm just going to quit my job. Mm. And it was around the time the semester was about to end with, just a grueling schedule of teaching, and just everything was intensive, especially with the new baby, too. And he said, you could do that, but why don't you just try over the summer to see if there's some other way you can make yourself feel a little bit better. And it was really fortuitous for me that right before the summer started, we had a guest speaker in town who was Richie Davidson.
Ah, okay. Can I tell everybody who Richie Davidson
is? Yes.
So Richie Davidson has been on this podcast. He was on the first podcast we did, him and the Dalai Lama. Richie Davidson is really the pioneer in terms of using neuroscience to examine the impact on the brain of contemplative practice, meditation, et cetera, et cetera. So he came to the University of Pennsylvania, gave his little shtick, and you were...
So Richie at that time was not out.
Oh, really?
He is an eminent affective neuroscientist. So he studies how the brain's emotion systems work. And he gave a wonderful talk, a keynote having nothing to do with mindfulness or meditation. And at the end of his talk, he actually showed these two images on the screen of brain scans, one of it, what he called a positive brain, a brain of somebody in a positive mood, and the other of a person in a negative mood. And he was just trying to make the point that the brain really looks different in its functioning and its profile as a function of mood. So at the end of his talk, I raised my hand and I said, how do I get that brain, the negative one, to look like that brain, the positive one? And he looked up and said, meditation. And that was all he said. And he said, that was the end of the question and answer session. That was it. And that's the first time I was sort of shocked. Like, you realize you're at Penn. Like, we don't use those words here. And he was serious. I did have a chance to talk to him a little bit later about it. And he was saying some of the work they were just starting. So this was a while back. But it got me curious. So that summer, I bought my first Mindfulness for Beginners book by Jack Kornfield and just committed to doing the practices. And it changed everything about my life. So that was on the one hand, the personal side. The professional side was, after doing this for several months, I realized that the thing that it seemed to be affecting was my attention. And my entire career as a neuroscientist had been spent studying the brain's attention system. So I just became extremely curious about how it was that this thing I was doing quietly by myself for 15 to 20 minutes a day was profoundly changing everything about my life and shifted my entire lab's research focus to explore that.
Okay, I want to unpack this just a little bit.
Yeah.
Walt, I'm going to get to you, I promise. You're going to make your life very difficult in just a few minutes, but let me stay with Amishi. It's so weird to call a guy with like all these stars and bars on his jacket Walt. I feel like I'm going to get in trouble. What do you mean it changed your attention? What do you mean by that? And how do and you and also what do you mean by it like changed so much about your internal weather? What do you mean by that too?
Okay, so in terms of, I mean, it took a while for me to realize that this is this thing called attention that I know a lot about from my day job. It really just changed the quality of my moment-to-moment life. I could look at my husband and listen to the words he was saying to me. I could be with my child, read a book, and actually look at the pages and see the images as I was sitting there with him. It was like I became more present to my circumstances. And nothing had changed really about the level of stress or demand, but I was more embodied in what I was trying to do. And there was less angst around everything going on. And then that's when I was sort of like putting it together and thinking, oh, okay, the thing that might be resulting in this benefit is the way I'm directing my attention, the way I'm making my mind is staying in the moment. And it's not just moving forward to the next thing that's going to happen in worry and anxiety-provoking thoughts or ruminating on bad things that have already happened that are kind of weighing on me. It shifted where my mind was in time.
And what were, just briefly, what was the practice you were doing? What kind of meditation?
So this was a basic, you know, mindfulness of breathing exercise where the instruction was to sit in an upright, comfortable posture, pay attention to the sensations of breathing, and when my mind wandered, to gently return it. And then opening up to more receptive practices, so open monitoring type practices, to anchor on the breath, but to really allow any thoughts, emotions, sensations come and then pass through.
Very, very interesting. Okay, so we'll continue with your story in a second, but let's get over to Walt. So how and when did you start meditating?
Well, when I met Amishi, and for all the reasons you just heard, that's what really introduced me. We had been since
you weren't doing cocaine.
I was not.
I
was doing war and a lot of it, I guess. And
yeah.
So we were coming back time and time again after each deployment, trying to reintegrate our soldiers back into society. And each time, we'd see soldiers just spiral out of control. And so the Army was really putting a lot of time and effort into how can we help our soldiers post deployment, and that's what led us to Amishi. And they asked to do a research project with our soldiers in Schofield Barracks, Hawaii.
Amishi did.
Yeah. And so she came out. We were introduced by an Army doctor that said, this may be a different way of trying this. So let's research the use of mindfulness in post-deployment and pre-deployment training and during a deployment.
And you're talking about guys coming back from Afghanistan and
Iraq. We just got back from Iraq. I was a brigade commander at the time, the 3rd Brigade, 25th Infantry Division. And we just got back from Iraq. And we had been, you know, on and off again, you know, a year gone, a year back, a year gone, a year back. So
This was back 2009 when you guys first met?
This was 2009.
Yeah.
And so we knew what we had been doing post-deployment was not working. So we really wanted to try something new, and this was presented to us as a way. So we put about 200 soldiers in the research, and I, even though I was a brigade commander, I somehow couldn't get myself into it. So I was kind of jealous of seeing about this.
Wait a minute. So when she came to you and said, yeah, we would like to get your soldiers to meditate, yeah. Was that not completely embarrassing? And like, why was that not outright rejected?
Well, she tricked me. So she she sounded like she did just a second ago. I could understand about every third word she was saying,
hey.
But I could read her charts, and the charts were the science was absolutely impressive, and that's what we were lacking in the military. We were providing a lot of information to soldiers, like, don't drink too much, you know, don't spend all your money at one time, don't go home and beat your wife or beat your spouse to do this. And none of this was working. We had provided them enough the availability of assistance, but we weren't really helping them, you know, pre-deployment. We weren't really helping them with the mental challenges of combat and the mental challenges of just stressful life within the military. And that's what this offered. And she really led with the science, which was absolutely convincing. She explained in 10 seconds what myself and the sergeant major for the brigade had been experiencing since our many combat deployments. So, you know, we were guilty. We sat there and realized we were not managing stress well and it was impacting our lives. And just the way she described it, we were convinced. I don't think the word meditation came up within the first meeting.
Yeah, but you knew it involved sitting, closing your eyes, and paying attention to your breath. What other word is for that?
Yeah, we were a little curious, but we weren't yet suspicious. We were like, because everything we'd been doing had just not been working.
You were so kind of desperate.
We were very open-minded. But then when explained to it that we're going to go through some training and teach soldiers to meditate and do this practice, the rest of us who didn't get into the research project, we started to teach ourselves. And we understand in the military, without a doubt, we carve out time every day to do physical fitness. It's at least an hour a day we provide for physical fitness. You see the benefits immediately. But we don't do any time for our mental fitness. And that's one of the one of our most powerful weapons, really. Not a weapon, is a soldier's mind itself, because we put them in a very complex, stressful environments, and they have to be able to interpret those environments and under great stress in split seconds and make very difficult decisions. So anything that could help them be in the moment and understand what they were seeing and not what they were trained to think they were going to see was very helpful. It was helpful in accomplishing our mission the right way, and it was helpful with managing stress with our soldiers, which we think will, you know, greatly help with the post-combat deployment and just post-combat stress.
I want to talk about the results of the study in a second, but what I'm surprised that I'm not hearing from you is rampant, acidic skepticism among your colleagues and peers. So did you not run into any of that?
Oh, we ran into quite a bit.
Okay.
So the sergeant major and I, multiple combat deployments, we were a bit desperate. So we were very open-minded. And we saw the science behind it. We were very eager. But the soldiers, I'm sure they said, oh, what is the colonel got us doing now? A lot of that. Great resistance. But it was something new. But I think shortly, people started to see a difference. And then they started to get buy-in. And then there's a community that practices as well. And I think, you know, athletes, especially professional athletes, are you know, in the military, we like to call our soldiers, you know, they are warrior athletes. But I think that comparison to professional athletes really helped them bring it in and say, well, there might be something here. Wouldn't you want to see the ball when it's getting thrown at you? Wouldn't you want to be in the moment when you're on a combat patrol in Iraq or Afghanistan? And the answer is certainly yes. Well, this can help you get there. But you do have to do some convincing, and soldiers have to see it. If they don't feel it, they're not going to come in. So they're just not going to practice. They're not going to practice on their own. But when soldiers started to feel results, you could sense they were more eager to practice on their own. And I think Amishi's results show that. The ones that would say, yes, I would do more on my own, they showed better results.
What did you find from that initial study?
Yeah, so the study was a very big study, the first of its kind, that the medical command had funded. And we were asking a bunch of key questions, because, again, this is the first time anything like this had been done. One question was really around dosing. So how much time do we need to take in order to have effects? And it was an 8-week period of time that we had devoted to the training. Some people got 24 hours over that 8 weeks, some got 16 hours, and some got 8 hours. And that's where we were not sure if we were going to have effects or not. The second question we wanted to ask was really around, well, if you're going to have some period of time, what should be the emphasis in that time? Should you spend your time talking to them about the downside of stress and the value of practicing, or should you just not really say much and just have them practice while they're in the room with the trainer? Sort of like if you go to the gym, do you want your personal trainer to tell you how great exercises, or just sit there and do the reps with you? And the other thing was just, how does it compare to other things that the Army was interested in trying out that were actively part of the profile of what the Army was doing for resilience? So comparing mindfulness training to positivity training, where the intention for positivity training is to cultivate more positive mood and see what the impact would be. And I'll just tell you, one of the research studies that that's already been published last year, which was the one with 8 hours. We found that we could go down to 8 hours and still find benefits. But if that 8 hours was just filled with the didactic, the information about how bad stress was and how great mindfulness was, it looked no different than doing nothing at all. The group that actually got the mindfulness training and mostly did practice in class significantly stayed stable over time, whereas the other group and the control group completely degraded in their attention.
How are you measuring attention?
So this is where the laboratory toolkit that I already had expertise in was really helpful. Most of the things in my lab were computer-based tests, brainwave recordings, functional MRI studies of attention. So we use that technology where essentially you're doing something like a simple video game that is quite boring, that requires you to actually overcome that boredom and your own internal chatter in order to do the task. So we saw how often people were able to press the button when they should and not mind wander and miss it completely, as well as how aware they were of whether their mind was wandering or not.
But Major General Walt wasn't worried about attention among his troops. He was worried about them beating their spouses and drinking too much right. and maybe running the cars off the road. So what?
So this is where it was really, I think I connected the dots in that first brief that he mentioned, which is essentially attention is one aspect of what we call executive control or cognitive control, the ability to make sure that the goals you have align with your behavior. So that you're holding in mind what your ethical code is, what you think the right way to be is, what you consider to be your aspirational way to be, and ensure that your behavior really serves that goal instead of losing entirely what you'd like to be doing and then not being able to follow it. So attention is the key kind of workhorse system that allows executive control to be possible. It's also the thing we need to regulate our emotions, to communicate well, to make decisions, to plan. So all of those things are tied to what he wanted to see as the end result. What I noticed is that the way that the Army was doing things at the time we arrived on the scene with this project was essentially, you know, in some sense, sort of death by PowerPoint. Tell people what the aspirational goal should be of how their behavior should look, but no tools on how to get there. And I think what we provided was a sort of a mental workout that would allow them to actually grow these capacities that were surely depleted after being, you know, in war. After combat deployment.
So, did you find any evidence other than anecdotal evidence that these guys were not only was their attentional capacity boosted, but that their behavior improved in some way?
Well, that was sort of the that was their own self-report.
That was more anecdotal.
That was anecdotal when they would kind of describe how. And most of the things were not about their day job. It wasn't like I'm a better soldier. It was like I can talk to my wife without yelling at her at night. Mm-hmm. You know, I can go to my daughter's soccer game and watch it. So it was really like the personal shifts that were happening in their lives, similar to what happened to me myself, that they were showing up to their life in a way that felt like it's the way they wanted to be as people.
But did you find that the stuff that you cared about, because you didn't care so much, at least correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I heard initially, you weren't looking to boost their attention span. You were looking for them not to ruin their own lives when they got home from deployment. Were you seeing less of that among those who got this training?
We were. But what we quickly learned was that this was something that wasn't going to be just post-deployment. We quickly learned that, wow, that you know we should be doing this pre-deployment because we realized as you know, senior folks that have had multiple deployments that everybody suffers from post-traumatic stress, everyone. But not everyone has to suffer from falling into despair or disorder. But what caused that? So it was really what we realized was we need to be doing this pre-deployment. We need to be learning how to manage stress and manage attention, which gives you a better soldier to be able to face those traumatic events because he's regulated or she's regulated and then they come out the other end, you know, much, much less stressful. So we saw immediately, wow, this is something that's not just for our post-deployment, though that was the reason it got us there. But it certainly we saw right away that the applications of this were much more beneficial. But you did see it. I felt it. A lot of our senior folks felt it because they've been deployed so much. They really felt like, wow, I'm really enjoying my time with my family. You know, you're so anxious to get home, but sometimes you just your mind didn't catch up. You're still deployed, and this really helped us just to really enjoy those special moments we were able to have with our family in between deployments.
When we come back, you say compassion is more powerful than bullets.
I do say that. I did say that. I also said before I deployed to Afghanistan on one of my deployments that we could win this war without killing one more person.
Stick around.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
There's a new answer for people in need of serious pain relief. Lidocare has created a one-of-a-kind pain relief patch that blocks pain for up to 8 hours. With the only non-water-based lidocaine patch on the market, Lidocare uses patent-pending technology to desensitize aggravated nerves for an odor-free, ultra-flexible, dry, and light solution to pain. The Lidocare Pain Patch from the makers of Blue Emu. For long-lasting relief you can wear. Available at CVS.
Can you tell me a little bit about the difference between pre-meditation Major General Walt Piatt and post-meditation?
Well, I think looking back, I could see times where we were in the moment, we made good decisions, we couldn't put our finger on it. I could see soldiers that experienced post-traumatic growth, but I saw a lot of soldiers experience post-traumatic stress disorder. And we couldn't figure out why that was. And we thought it was just because we were training very hard, we were creating combat-like conditions within our training so that when they got to combat, they were prepared for that type of stressful environment. What we may have been doing is elevating stress to much higher levels to our soldiers and not teaching them how to regulate, which is the missing ingredient. But we saw different examples of that before we even knew what mindfulness was or were introduced over our many deployments. And we just tried to figure, why was it that way? And when I saw the science behind Amishi's work, that's what really convinced me right away that there's something here we need to pursue. But immediately what I see is, because I think some people come about it naturally, that they self-regulate, they're able to deal in stressful moments while still being, you know, very much in the moment and in a stressful combat operation, and make that split-second decision and make the right one. Whether it's to use force or not to use force, it's one of the hardest decisions a soldier has to make, and he makes it very quickly, not always with complete information, but you don't want them have to be a high level of stress when they make it, because they normally make the wrong one. So we saw examples of that. So when we saw the application of learning to meditate, now it's just you're able to get away from the stereotype that we have to be multitasking and to be effective in the military, that the more you can do, the better you're doing it. And this kind of proved to me just the opposite. So now I'm very comfortable with taking a pause, studying a problem, or even walking away from it and doing some type of reflection, even if I don't have time to sit for 20 minutes, even just walking out in the courtyard of the Pentagon and just do what I call a mindful walk, just walk through and focus on, you know, nothing, and then come back. And then I'm able to get things done in a much more efficient way. So I've seen efficiency in my own life from this, but I've also seen soldiers become much more, you know, happier at home post-deployment and much more effective during their deployment, during their careers.
What about you? Are you happier at home, and are you just happier in your moment-to-moment experience?
I am, and I think I was. I mean, I was very happy, but I could see the stress. I could feel it coming back. You know, things were irritate me. You know, just getting stuck in traffic. You know, loud noises, things going wrong that really never bothered me before. I was very patient. I thought very tolerant, but my wife noticed it, and then so I'd always made sure I was exercising, and exercising was my pre-mindfulness way to regulate. That was what I did, and I had to do more and more of it in order to get that feeling back that I was being relaxed. But you feel it. It's not like you're some ticking time bomb like you might see on TV, but it's the little things that start to build up on you, and then you just, you know, you blow up with anger on something that was just so insignificant, you know, prior to all these events in your life, that you start to realize something's wrong. I mean, you're not spiraling into disorder. That's a very serious case, but all soldiers are affected by it. And if you're not recognizing it and dealing with it, then things could get a lot worse. But what I found is if you're less stressful pre-traumatic event, you handle the trauma better, and you certainly come out of it a lot better. Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense, and the policy implications are gigantic. But so Amishi, that was the first study back in 2009. I know there have been more. So can you walk me through just basically what you've been finding?
Right. So I think that this overall profile is very similar to what I described to you, and I don't know if that was clear in what I had said before. If we look at people that are going through very high-stress situations, and that could be soldiers preparing for deployment, the deployment cycle itself, or in the civilian context, you know, undergrads preparing for finals. I mean, anything that is a high-stress period of time, protracted over multiple weeks, has an impact on attention. We know it has an impact on well-being. We know people report feeling more stressed and unhappy. But what we've been able to track is that if you look at their attention using these simple computer games, at the beginning of that interval and at the end, attention declines. And that, I think, is kind of an important thing for people to realize, is that there are costs to going through a high-stress interval. And that if those same attentional resources are necessary for you to regulate your mood, to have successful interactions with people, and to solve the problems that are part of what makes the interval high stress, and you have less of that resource, you're going to be compromised. Right? So when I speak about that period of time and what happens to attention, we're really talking about figuring out some way we can build cognitive resilience. So allowing people to grow the capacities that we know weaken over high stress periods of time. And so that's what we've done. We've looked at various high-stress groups, undergrads, accountants, football players, all during kind of intensive periods of time. And sure enough, we find that the groups that don't get the mindfulness training or get some other form of training that doesn't emphasize this present moment awareness degrade in their attention and their mood. And the people that get the mindfulness training and actually practice it stay stable or even get a little bit better than where they started. So that's sort of the broad brush of the kinds of things that we're looking at.
But you keep working with the military, right?
And so the military thing has been very interesting. So, you know, in this first study that we did in 2009, my partner in all of it was Dr. Liz Stanley at Georgetown.
Yes, I've interviewed her, yeah.
Yeah, and so the thing that's really remarkable about Liz is that she sort of embodies the expertise of somebody that knows a lot about what it means to be a service member. She was in the military herself. And she knows a lot about what it means to be a mindfulness practitioner. But that's a very rare combination. Mm-hmm. She also happens to be a professor of security studies. So she professionally knows about this area. I mean, there's one Liz Stanley. There's not hundreds of them. So now that we found that the training is effective, that offering mindfulness training pre-deployment can actually protect against the decline that you normally see, the Army's concern was, well, how do we grow this capacity? How do we have more people that can get the training? And so over the last several years, what I've been doing, and I've been grateful that that Walt's been part of our advisory board, is trying to figure out how we can make the training, again, low dose, low tech, highly accessible and scalable.
So basically, you need a lot of trainers.
Yes,
we need more people
that can do it. So there's two ways we could go. One way was, let's take people that already know a lot about mindfulness. Let's get mindfulness certified trainers and train them in how to deliver our program that we had designed for soldiers so that they already have the mindfulness piece and we'll teach them about contextualizing it for the community. But the other way we were going to go, simultaneous with this strategy, was let's get Army trainers, sports psychologists that know how to train soldiers well, who may or may not be soldiers, you know, themselves, but they know how to train service members so that they're high performance. And we train them in our program. And that's what we're doing now. We're kind of looking head to head to see which group is more effectively able to offer the program so that soldiers benefit.
Why not use technology, like have the training delivered through an app or something like that?
So we have done that, too. That's something that's been ongoing in my lab, is looking at various apps to see. I think that that's a good strategy to go forward. So far, our challenge has been that you have to have some buy-in and some accountability that the app is actually engaged in. Even if you turn it on and the recording plays, there's no human ensuring that people are following it. So what I'm interested in trying now is, let's have an app where there's some kind of coach.
That's somebody. That's 10% happier.
I know that.
Yes.
I know that. Let's have a coach. Let's have some kind of bookending of in-person sessions so that they know what this is about, what they're right. getting into. And then throughout the process, they are able to get the assistance that they need. So exactly. I mean, you and I have even started talking about that, is how are ways in which we can use this kind of, I think, a next generation of app that takes into account the human interaction to guide people, to coach people, to really allow scalable delivery.
So we could do like a 10% happier military style. But the thing is, I would be the wrong guy to be involved in that, because I'm like 5'7" and 120 pounds and I've never been in a fight. Let me revise that. I've never been in a fight that I've won. so I might not be the right guy. But I definitely think there's I'd be interested to see what the numbers show you, because I would imagine in-person pedagogy will be more impactful than an app.
So far, that's what we're finding.
Yeah.
Is giving people an app basically it's showing us no difference depending on the app. So if we give them a relaxation app or a brain game app with like cognitive attention tasks or a mindfulness app, there's no difference. Doing something is better than nothing.
Yeah, but if you want to scale this thing, that's the question. Can you train enough human beings who actually understand how to teach other human beings how to do mindfulness, which is a subtle art? That seems to be the problem.
That's my next grant.
That's your next grant.
That's the question I want to really pursue. And like you said, the challenge with any research design is having enough numbers. And testing out different delivery models, right? So like I described to you, is the mindfulness expertise the key, or is it the context expertise that's the key? So far, I'll give you the kind of where we're at with those results. It looks like the thing that seems to really win out in terms of soldiers appreciating and following the training and benefiting from the training from our laboratory measures is the one that's taught by the Army trainer.
Interesting. So they need to be able to relate to the person who's teaching them this practice.
And it's not the case that the Army trainers are service members themselves, but
they're
sports psychologists that
know
how
to
exactly. They can relate to this, the particulars of this culture.
So if you bring in like a meditation teacher who's got 30 years of, you know, talking about the Buddha and you know, like a lot of these people have this like soft purr in their voice, and they're, you know, it feels like they're trying to give you a Reiki massage with their vowels. It's like those people are not going to work with the military.
So far, it doesn't seem to be the right way to go.
No, I mean, it's just intuitive on my end, at least. They don't work with me.
Right, exactly.
And you know, I'm not in the military for a lot of good reasons. Do you have a hunch about what the best way to get this out to people?
Well, I will say at first, Liz Stanley was very helpful in this because she did relate to soldiers. I mean, she had personal trauma. And so that was just her. And she was very intelligent, and being a college professor, she really identified with soldiers and that language. And we've done some work with Amisha on that. Just to be able to talk the soldier athlete language, very helpful. As we take a lot of fitness advice from folks who aren't in the military, but if they show something that's working, well, everybody pays attention to them. Okay, what's the latest gig? So when CrossFit came out, you know, military is very interested. Our soldiers were very interested. Some of those exercises we've been doing in the military for years, but the way we were presenting it wasn't as cool, and so it didn't appeal as much. But we have had a lot of good work in the military lately with apps because of our young soldiers identify them, especially when it comes to military schooling, where they are more likely to do all the pre-class work on an app, and we've seen higher graduation rates in some very difficult classes, such as Jump Master course, where you got to learn how to be in charge of an airplane that's going to put out parachutists. It's a very difficult school to pass and requires an incredible attention span. But when we downloaded things on apps that they could do all the pre-course work, saw a lot higher success rates. So I'm a little bit more optimistic, but it will follow the science. I know the hands-on, someone who identifies much better. But we do physical training every day, and everybody in the platoon is about what you normally do every day, or a squad. They're all pretty good experts. You know, they grow up in that environment learning how to do physical fitness, so they're able to lead every single day. So if we can train ourselves, and I know that's going to be a hard startup, I think we'll get there because they'll see the benefits and they'll want to do it. Soldiers don't want to miss physical training in the morning. They just don't want to because they see the benefits of it. It helps them with their promotion, helps them with their life. They feel better. They get the results. And if you're stationed in Hawaii, you want to go to the beach on a weekend too, so that doesn't help either. So, I mean, it really helps. But when they see the benefit, they go after it with a hunger. And especially when they hear about athletes, Seattle Seahawks doing that, Russell Wilson. I mean, people see that. They want it. Mm-hmm. They want to get after this. So I think we'll get there. It will take some convincing. It's military. Just the Army is very big organization. And when you come in, it almost sounds like it's too good to be true. And I think we still have a lot of convincing to do with some of our top leaders that this isn't magic. This isn't too good to be true. This is real, and the science will prove it. And your brain does show the effects from practicing this. And it really doesn't cost a lot. I mean, we spend a lot of money defending our nation with building our military and all the services. This is one I think is affordable. The payoff is enormous. To my mind, we're going to get there. It's just going to take a little bit longer. But Amisha's going to lead that charge for us.
So I'm just to drill down on that a second. You are part of the Army brass. So you, but as you talk to your colleagues, you're still bumping up against some skepticism?
Skepticism plus, you know, it's another thing we want people to do. And soldiers have a lot of things coming down from the top here. Just do this. And time is one of the resources we just don't have a lot of. And so it's very hard when you're coming into an organization, say, here, carve out this time to do this. The first resistance is no. Doesn't matter what you're asking, because if you're trying to take time away that they've already have scheduled in a very overloaded, overscheduled time units every day are, to ask them to take just even 10 minutes, it's like they can't find it. But when they see the results, they certainly find it. We'll, no matter how tough our schedule is, we will make time for physical fitness. This just has to get, we have to grow it that way. Then the priority will be on our mental fitness, our physical fitness, and then everything else, I think, will just do everything else better in less time and be more efficient.
Can you imagine a near-term future where mindfulness and meditation are part of basic training?
Yes.
That is a crazy notion.
Well, I think the soldiers see it. We've tried a lot. I mean, the Army, what we have in the Army now is what we call our comprehensive soldier fitness. We understand there's more than just physical fitness. It's sleep, nutrition, spirituality, and mental fitness. Now, how we go about that is what we're trying to introduce mindfulness in, because I think in basic training is probably the best place to introduce it. And it's probably the best place because it's very high stress. Although it's very organized, great instructors, take really good care of the soldiers, but they're away from home. And it's culture shock when you come into the Army. If you've never been in maybe played high school sports, you may be a little bit used to that kind of group shock, I guess, of really being a hard schedule to keep and not getting a lot of sleep and having to listen to someone else tell you what to do every second of the day. But we have to teach our soldiers how to be soldiers. And I think this is where it really, really would fit. It would reduce stress from the get-go. They would see the benefits of it because they see the benefits of physical fitness right away. Some of them come, they've never done a lot of physical fitness. So we take extreme care to slowly introduce them while preventing injuries. It took us years to realize this. I don't know why, but it really did. We realized we can't start just doing 100 push-ups a day. Some soldiers can't do 10, and we want them to do 100. So we slowly build it up. And as we've studied, stress fractures and running and load bearing, how much weight and all this over the years. So we're really smart on physical fitness. We just need to follow the science more on mental fitness. And I think that will prove mindfulness is the best course for us.
Yeah, I think this is amazing. But, Amishi, you know this. There are those in the sort of more traditional circles in the meditation world who think you're taking this ancient, sort of essentially peaceful mental art and giving it to people who are violent. How do you respond to that?
I think that, from my point of view, if you're going to have an 18-year-old and send him to a war zone with a weapon that can destroy an entire village, why wouldn't you want to make sure he has access to his full capacities to make the right decisions? And that's what this is trying to do. So in some sense, it's not about, making better killers. It's that when force is to be used, it's used in a way that's appropriate, not reactive. That the decisions that are made are informed by people being able to hold their own ethical code, even in crazy, violent circumstances. And that's what's not appreciated. It's that, we live in a time where we have a military. We live in a culture and a country that is inactive combats. I mean, the combat situations. And they have the capacity as individuals to actually do a lot of harm. So it's not that we're going to prevent those circumstances from happening. It's the nature of the world. But even at the individual level, if we can empower them to be better able to access their own ability to prevent bad things from happening, why wouldn't we want to do that?
I agree with you. I mean, Liz Stanley, who has been discussed a lot in this podcast, who, just so everybody remembers, is somebody who's worked with Amishi and has also spent some time training the U.S. Marines in how to do mindfulness. I asked her once this question of, are you training better baby killers, as some in the sort of old school contemplative circles have alleged. And she said, no, we're training people to kill fewer babies, to make wiser, more effective decisions in the field and to be more resilient when they come home. So anyway, that's a long way of saying I agree with you. But Mamisha, you wanted me to ask Walt about one of his expressions, which I find really interesting, especially given the source. You say, compassion is more powerful than bullets.
I did. I do say that. I did say that. I also said before I deployed to Afghanistan on one of my deployments as a battalion commander, I told our battalion that we could win this war without killing one more person. Because warfare is much more complex than just killing. And sometimes the overuse of force builds combat power, what we call in the military, builds sympathy and power for your enemy. So if you apply force incorrectly, it actually has the opposite effect that you're using it for. In this type of war, you cannot kill your way out of it. You will not kill to win. You must be able to build while using force with surgical precision. And compassion was, from my experience, was much more powerful and much more effective because it allowed us to, one, lead with respect for the people of Afghanistan, for the example I'll use, for my good friend, the governor of Paktika at the time, Gulab Mangal, and we built a long-standing friendship. Our job was to build, not to destroy. And if we went in there with the mentality that we're going to be effective and decisive through killing, that was really just a naive approach to warfare. It's much more complicated, and therefore compassion to the Afghan people and the struggle that they were enduring in Paktika province, where I wrote about, and I said this, was we needed to understand them. We needed to be compassionate to their needs, and that way it separated them from the enemy that was trying to undermine their struggling and fledgling government that they were trying to build. So it was actually a very effective tool. And I'm not doing it to trick. I mean, these are real emotions that we felt for our friends. They were, they still are our friends. And I think Gulab Mangal said it best that when we left Paktika, I asked him, you know, why were we successful? This was in 2005, very successful election. Paktika was not going to vote in the national election because it was too violent when we got there. The new governor, and with the help of us, we believe we were part of his larger security plan, we subordinated ourselves to the people of Paktika. And almost 100% of the people of Paktika province voted. It was really kind of a tribal vote, so it was a little bit different, but 50% of them were female. And Gulab Mangal got a personal phone call from Hamid Karzai congratulating him on what was supposed to be the most violent province in the election, turned out to be the most peaceful. But it was because we understood the struggles that the Afghan people were going on, that we weren't just focusing on the enemy. And I also told our folks another one that confused soldiers a lot. I said, you know, if we focus on the enemy, we ignore the threat, because the threat is much larger. You're talking about, you know, very serious government complex systems that have to be built in Afghanistan for people. So it was really the decisive means to that end was capacity building within the government. That gave the Afghan people what they needed, and that forced them to look internally to their government. And when in the enemy then separated, and it was easier for us to find the enemy, and we could, if we had to use force, it was with surgical precision. But there were several times, I'll just use one example, where we left a village after doing a medical demonstration all day long. We brought female doctors in so the females could be seen. It was a very positive day at the request of the government. But as we left the convoy, our last vehicle, there was a grenade thrown on the vehicle. And the gunner did what he was trained to do. He jumped down into his turret. He yelled grenade. Luckily, the grenade didn't go in the turret. It rolled off to the back of the vehicle, got stuck in the equipment we were carrying, and exploded. He immediately jumped back up, manned his gun, saw the figure that threw the grenade running, and in a split second decided not to shoot. And there were so many children around, and he had a 50 caliber machine gun. He would have killed many innocent people. Plus, he saw that the person fleeing could be no more than maybe 10 to 12 years old. So in that split second, that soldier, by not acting, I'd say acted decisively. And later on, we went back to the village and we said, okay, they thought we were going to go door to door, search every house, arrest every man. We didn't, but we stayed there. And we said, let's come to a resolution of this. And they didn't. But so I left and I said, please bring the person responsible to our base camp, and we want to talk to them. 2 weeks later, the tribe brought in the father and the young boy that threw the grenade on that vehicle.
Wow!
And they pleaded for us to arrest the father and leave the son to take back to the village, but they were offering his father in his place. And the tribe agreed on it. And by the Afghan way, we had every right then to arrest the father. We decided not to. We introduced the boy to the vehicle and the team that was in that vehicle that he threw that grenade on that day. And he saw that we weren't the evil infidels. We were just boys at one time, just like he was. We were men, just like his father was, and that we really wanted to bring peace to this very difficult land. We built more relationships with that tribe that day through this compassion, which began militarily decisive, because we got incredible intelligence from this village the rest of our deployment. And they solidified their stance against the Taliban. They would not allow them to come in and influence their young kids to take up arms against the government. And we never had to worry about that village again. So I know it goes against what you hear a lot of military saying, but I'll tell you, our military is trained to do that. That's what I think makes the United States Army very, very good. We understand that just because we're an army and we have force, the best thing to do is not to use it until you absolutely have to.
You know, I find everything you just said very compelling, and but I just wonder about the reputational cost to you of, you know, I understand you wrote a couple of books of poetry. You're a guy who says compassion is more powerful than bullets. You're hanging out with this unreconstructed meditation person over here, and do they like call you Major General Moonbeam behind your back, or what? Like, what is this a problem for you, or is it good?
Well, it's one of the things I like about your book, because you realize, you know, you still got to go to work every day and you still have to be demanding. I'm the director of Army Operations, and they may call me other things behind my back. I'm sure they do, but there's still very, very very dangerous world out there. We got to do very, very tough things with people, and you got to get people to do things they don't necessarily want to do. Defense and security is a tough business, and especially with the increase of terrorist threats to our homeland. But I think this helps us do it better. So I make no apologies. I open up, but I do think there are a lot of soldiers that are like me. I don't think I'm any different. I think we realize that our mental capacity is very important, and if we don't care for it and understand it, we're going to burn ourselves out. We're going to burn our soldiers out. We saw it. We still see it, unfortunately, in many people. And we can't just enhance soldiers to make an optimal warrior through technology. It's just not going to work. We have to be able to give our soldiers the tools that they can manage stress and pay attention, because the stressful environments we put them in demand it. So I don't know if people call me names. I mean, I'm proud of my service, and I'm proud of many of my peers. I think a lot of people write from my experience, writing was very therapeutic for me. It was a way of letting emotions go of some very difficult things, but it was also a way of honoring those who would serve in these incredibly difficult positions away from their families for years at a time. The way you understand it, I mean, you were there. It's just you're put in some very difficult places, and it's just a way to identify. But I think our Army understands now that we're beyond the stereotypes of you got to be able to just deal with it, soldier, that it's just stress, deal with it.
Rub some dirt in it.
Yeah, and those were the days gone past. We understand the complexities of the world. We understand the complexities we put our soldiers in. We just want to give them the tools that they can do their job to the utmost ability, do it correctly, while protecting the innocent and capturing and denying our adversaries the ability to have their will against us or our nation or our allies.
What's your daily practice like?
I'll tell you, I have a very difficult job. The director of Army Operations is not light. So I have to be in the office. For my first meeting is at 6:30 in the morning, then I have another one at 7 o'clock. But what I do is I run into work in the morning, because I live a few miles from the Pentagon. And so after my two briefings, when I get another shot to go to do about a 20-minute workout, and then I stop, and I either in my office or in a corner in the gymnasium in the Pentagon, I go from 5 to 10 minutes, and it's really been limiting in this job. So I do that every morning at work.
Of just, you know, paying attention to the breath, and when you get lost, start
right.
Again.
Yeah. And like you said, it's like holding a fish, I think is what you said. Yes, very,
it is
very
like
much like it.
Fish.
And in this job, it's really hard, because there's a lot of demands waiting for me. But I realized because when I first took the job, I stopped like practicing for a month, and I could feel myself just really not handling things well.
Yeah, it's like your inner toxicity goes through the roof. Yeah.
And you've got a million things, real life, coming at you every hour that are happening around the world that you have to help, you have to address for the Army. So that's how I get after it every morning. So I make that a priority. I make physical fitness a priority in the morning, and I make my practice a priority in the morning. And then, like I said, during the day, so normally by 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm exhausted. It's like you've done a full day and you still have another full day to go. So I'll normally walk out to the courtyard of the Pentagon or go find a corner and stop for maybe 5 or 10 more minutes if I can. So that's I have to shorten my time. I have to put some increments in it, but it's what I can do, so I do it.
I mean, to my ears, it sounds great. I tell people 5 to 10 minutes a day is awesome, and it sounds like you're doing even more than that. And also, I'm just reading between the lines. I suspect you're probably bleeding it into sort of your daily activities as much as possible, which is really kind of where the rubber hits the road. What about you, Amishi? What's your daily practice?
Yeah, I've been fortunate to be able to carve time out after my children and husband are out of the house to do about, I like to do 30 minutes. So I was doing similar to what you said. I mean, I was telling people 12 minutes seems to be the sweet spot in some of our studies. But when I pushed it past that, I felt even better. So I'm trying to do 30 minutes. And I like to combine the mindfulness practice with a compassion practice. So I do loving kindness practice as well.
So we've talked about loving kindness a lot on this show, but just in case we've got first time listeners, that is a practice, just to put it briefly, where you kind of envisioning people in a systematic way and sending them good vibes.
Yeah, or yourself.
Yeah, and yourself. Yes.
And actually, one of the things I wanted to mention, just because you were asking about Walt regarding, you know, he is an outlier. He's an amazing person and definitely distinct than probably most other people. But thankfully, there are other enlightened leaders that we've been able to meet in the military. And in addition to all the work we're doing with active duty service members, we're also working now with military spouses. Mm. And what's very interesting about that is it's kind of going from the spouses benefiting themselves to then the husbands, mostly in most cases, asking what's going on and taking some of the materials that we're providing the spouses to take back to their units to practice.
Trojan horse.
So it's very interesting. Yeah, it's very interesting how things are shifting, and that the Surgeon General of the Army is interested in promoting this.
Really?
So yeah. I mean, she asked me to brief 400 of her top leaders in this topic of mindfulness.
So from your point of view, are you still running into some cultural obstacles as you try to?
No. I would say the obstacles are real, but the obstacles are not entry into doing it. The obstacles are how you can offer this in a way that really is best practices for implementation. So most people that I meet, leaders, I say, I want to do a mindfulness project with your group. And they say, sure, I can give you 2 hours in one afternoon. And so my intention in my work is to say, really, you know, would 2 hours in one afternoon have any positive lasting impact? So our projects are now really asking around, again, similar questions. How low can we push the dose? If we can get some amount of time over a couple of weeks, how should we do that? Should we do 2 4-hour workshops? Should we do an hour a day? You know, these are not the most maybe scientifically juicy areas, but they're practically so important. So those are the kinds of things that I'm interested in tackling now is how do we provide this? How do we scale it up? How do we have a low-dose format? How do we have apps, for example, that could help better support what people are doing at all levels, from small unit leaders to, you know, higher-level leaders to everybody?
What's your vision for the, let's just say, not distant future? Like, what's your vision for the role of mindfulness, not only in the military, but in the larger society in the not-too-distant future?
I think that's been my interest all along. We've come now with, 50 years of work that make it obvious that our public health leaders would say, you know, daily physical activity is necessary for physical well-being. And my vision, my hope, is that we understand that the mind is the same way and that we have the science that can provide guidance on what the daily mental exercises should be for psychological well-being. And that's sort of the work that I'm pursuing, is how to answer those questions to inform a larger enterprise. So it's not just that it's important, but how do you actually implement it in your daily life?
We're almost out of time, but before we go, I just want to ask you, as a very prominent member of the contemplative neuroscience community, that's the name for people who use neuroscientists who study meditation. There's been some controversy about the study, the quality of the science in around mindfulness and meditation, not just the neuroscience, but all of the science. Criticisms ranging from the study design isn't good, the people doing the studies are kind of in the tank, they're pro-meditation, so they're biased. What's your view on this? Can we trust the science, or is it being hyped?
I mean, I think that absolutely it's being hyped. I think that the cultural momentum is way outpacing the rigor that we need to be able to make concrete with certainty guidance, provide guidance. And I do think that we have to take a look at any positivity biases there might be. And that's the criticism, is that essentially there's an overabundance of studies that are finding benefits, and you can see it. And I think that's not going to serve us at all. And I think that that kind of statement, those kind of statements being made is helpful, because then publishing the study in which you found nothing, or publishing the study in which you actually found something that you didn't expect, like things got worse in a way that you didn't anticipate. Those are all going to become valuable for us to get a more accurate picture of what's going on.
I just love having the two of you on, because my whole mission is to sorry, that's a kind of a military term, but my mission is to make this attractive, make this practice attractive to people who would otherwise reflexively reject it. So to have a hard-charging, type A neuroscientist and mom and a major general in the U.S. Army coming on talking about it in the way in which you do, which is sort of down-to-earth, relatable, but also sincere, is, I think, extremely valuable. So thank you to both of you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Dan.
All right, there's another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you like it, I'm going to hit you up for a favor. Please subscribe to it, review it, and rate it. I want to also thank the people who produced this podcast, Josh Cohan, Lauren Efron, Sarah Amos, and the head of ABC News Digital, Dan Silver. And hit me up at Twitter, Dan B. Harris. See you next time. If you like 10% Happier, I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
I'm Shimon Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.